cigarettes and the ghettos play. Long nights on a hot summer's block where you sip your brew and never touch your glass. This is for eyes that cry like yours and learn to smile again. Rise above the pain. This is for you and your crew, the ones that's true. Will always love you no matter what you do.
Rise is the light, the light, the light, the light, the light. Rise is the light, the light, the light. Rise is the light, the light, the light. Your light, your light. Rise is the light, your light, my light.
This is for soldiers who bust their guns in the name of freedom, not the game of funds. True queens who raise their kids, implement the knowledge, show them how to live. This is for those who stand in line to feed their babies while we're running out of time. This is for
Spitfire breeds the lives of women of color in Montreal. We come together to say no to the silencing of our voices. Welcome to Spitfire, Women of Color Radio, every last Wednesday of the month on CKUT 90.3 FM. The time is 6:06.
We have a jam-packed program this evening, and I would like to give a little shout-out to Miss Emily, who's in the studio with us today.
Hey, Emily.
So we welcome back into the studio journalist and critic Christiana Collison for an interview with moi about the Funnier Racist panel discussion that took place at McGill in March.
Finally, we have an exciting piece from Mercedes, who will be discussing the film Life is But a Dream, a recent documentary about Beyoncé. We will then open up the floor for a roundtable discussion on the question of representation of women of color in pop culture. All this coming up next on Spitfire Radio.
before our piece with Christiana coming up, here is a piece on Toni Morrison by our one and only Spitfire, Alyssa Clutterbuck.
The Spitfire Woman of the Month, saluting Toni Morrison. This month's Woman of the Month is a pioneer, a transformative writer who has for over 5 decades written stories that have reached out to women of color everywhere, providing richly textured words that will help us get to a place of healing and peace. Toni Morrison was born in Lorain, Ohio, and was the second of 4 children in a working class family. As a child, Morrison read constantly. Her father taught her numerous folk tales of the black community, a way of storytelling that would later become infamous in her writings. In 1949, Morrison entered Howard University to study English. Morrison received a Bachelor of Arts in English from Howard in 1953, then earned a Master of Arts degree, also in English, from Cornell University in 1955, for which she wrote a thesis on suicide in the works of William Faulkner and Virginia Woolf. After graduation, Morrison became an English instructor at Texas Southern University in Houston, Texas, then returned to Howard to teach English. In 1958, she married Harold Morrison, a Jamaican architect and fellow faculty member at Howard University. They had 2 children, Harold and Slade, and divorced in 1964. After the divorce, she moved to Syracuse, New York, where she worked as a textbook editor. A year and a half later, she went to work as an editor at the New York City headquarters of Random House. There, Morrison played an important role in bringing black literature, especially black women's literature, into the mainstream. She edited books by such authors as Toni Cade Bambara, Angela Davis, and Gail Jones. Morrison began writing fiction as part of an informal group of poets and writers at Howard University, who they met weekly to discuss their work. She went to one meeting with a short story about a black girl who longed to have blue eyes. The story later evolved into her first novel, The Bluest Eye, which was published in 1970. Toni continued to explore African-American experiences in works such as Sula, Song of Solomon, and Beloved, which won the 1988 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. Morrison developed a strong following among both readers and critics, who fell for her lyrical style, sharp observations, and vibrant storytelling. Morrison became a professor at Princeton University in 1989 and continued to produce great works. In recognition of her contributions to her field, she received the 1993 Nobel Prize in Literature, making her the first African-American to be selected for this award. The next year, her novel Jazz was published, and she established a special workshop for writers and performers known as the Princeton Atelier. Along with her novels Paradise and Love, Morrison wrote several children's books, including The Big Box, The Book of Mean People, and The Enter the Grasshopper. These were written in collaboration with her son, Slade. In 2006, Toni Morrison retired from her post at Princeton. That year, the New York Times Book Review named Beloved the best novel of the past 25 years. Ms. Morrison's work has been an inspirational force for young women of color writers and for those who believe in the healing qualities of literature. We celebrate her work and her everlasting impact on the face of contemporary English, post-colonial thought, and the minds and bodies and souls of women of color everywhere.
Due to traffic issues, we'll be
listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio. Due to traffic issues and like ridiculous bouts of giggling in the studio.
Hi,
tonight.
Montreal.
So confused. We'll be airing a piece by Mae Nam on Peggy Smith.
Awesome. Thanks for that intro, Yaz.
Yay!
On March 29, 2010, Inter-University Center on Globalization Work, also known as CRIMT, and the Labor Law and Development Research Laboratory organized an international conference entitled Regulating Decent Work for Domestic Workers, International and Comparative Dialogue, Celebrating the ILO at 90, and Preparing for Standard Setting into the Future. The conference was held at the Faculty of Law at McGill University. This international seminar brought together leading experts from around the world to discuss the regulatory possibilities and challenges associated with the International Labor Organization's landmark decision to move forward on setting standards to protect domestic workers. As an organizer and participant of the conference, I had an opportunity to discuss the health and safety concerns of domestic workers with Professor Peggy Smith of Iowa University and Washington University in St. Louis. Professor Smith researches the legal implications caused by the separation between race and gender, home and work, and work and family. And here's a part of our conversation on the task of establishing standards for domestic works in terms of occupational health and safety. So what sort of issues do you think that these particular workers face, which are different from other workers?
You know, a lot of people talk today about the particularities of domestic service that can make it challenging to regulate. Those include, for example, the fact that the work is done within the privacy of individual homes. They also include the fact that most workers are working solo, as opposed to most industrial workers who tend to be working with other people and who are largely performing their work in the public space.
Mm-hmm. There's one thing that I found really interesting in your talk, and you talked about how we imagine the home as this sort of tranquil place that people withdraw to and relax in. Can you just comment on that and how that affects how we conceive of domestic workers' rights and safety in their workplace?
I think fundamentally there is an ideological separation that we're still struggling to overcome as between family and market, as between home and work. And we clearly think about the work that domestics do as work that belongs within the home space, as work that belongs to the family. And as a result of that divide, we tend not to treat domestic service work as a legitimate form of work. I think historically we've looked at legitimate forms of work as work that has occurred in the market, work that has occurred in the public space. And in the United States, you can go back and you can look at early efforts to regulate domestic service, and you have statements to the effect of, you know, this kind of work was work that was really going to be good to turn young white women into housewives. This was going to be their training ground. Mm-hmm. And no one could conceive of this work as hard, back-breaking labor. Because to do that, you had to also acknowledge that the work that women do in the home for no pay can also be incredibly difficult and incredibly onerous. Mm-hmm.
So when we look at workers and conceiving of this work as not worth being paid for, as being sort of natural to what a woman would do as a wife, mm-hmm. or as a sister or as a mother, what types of occupational health and safety issues do we see specifically related to this work for the workers?
Yeah. One of the things that I think will surprise most people is today, particularly in the U.S., but also in a lot of other countries, because of the aging of the population, increasingly you have domestics who are providing home care, home care labor, mainly to people who are elderly and disabled within their own homes. Home care and related occupations have a higher rate musculoskeletal injuries than workers in coal mines. And I think people are blown away by that fact. And because this is work in the home, I don't think we come to appreciate the significance of that. But hopefully, you know, with these types of conferences would increase awareness about the injuries associated with this work, people will begin to push for regulation. More importantly, I think you're going to see a push for regulation because when you have home care workers who are experiencing such incredibly high rate of workplace injuries, there is a clear negative impact on clients because home care workers are leaving the job. Yeah. And when they leave the job, they usually list the two most common reasons they give for leaving home care is one, the compensation is incredibly poor, and two, the rates of injury are incredibly high. Mm-hmm. And so ultimately, it's not only in the interest of the workers, but it's in the interest of clients. In terms of clients who are going to increasingly need access to home care workers as the population continues to age.
For these workers who are suffering from these work-related injuries, in the U.S., in your research, what have you seen has been the support for these workers to gain some sort of work-related compensation?
So compensation generally isn't the issue. If you happen to be a worker who is employed by a home care agency. So there is a clear distinction between those workers who have a very clear, defined relationship that is protected by law and workers who are hired directly by a homeowner or a client. Those are the workers who generally have difficulty in some states getting compensation, workers' compensation, right? If you're an agency-employed worker and you're injured on the job, you're going to be entitled to workers' compensation. But workers' compensation is only half of the workplace safety and health regime in any country, right? Workers' compensation basically says, now that you've been injured, what are we going to do to help you? And the other half, occupational safety and health, says, what are we going to do to prevent the likelihood that you're going to get injured in the first place? And that we've done very little about.
Okay.
We've done a somewhat good job in terms of compensation, again, if you happen to be an agency-employed worker. What we're struggling with is, how do you prevent these injuries in the first place? And part of the reason we're struggling so hard is because people are hesitant to impose these types of regulations within the private home.
So what kind of regulations are you talking about?
So, for example, again, if we're looking at those workers that are employed by agencies, those workers are covered by the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Act. And one of the standards that would go a long way to helping those workers who have all of these injuries caused by overexertion would be an ergonomic standard, right? An ergonomic standard that focuses on how they do the work and looks at devices that would help them do the work better. We actually had such a standard in the U.S. That was enacted during the Clinton administration, but never took effect because it was repealed the very first day that President Bush took office.
Okay.
But that's the kind of standard. That standard would not just help domestic service workers, it would help all workers.
So what sort of strategies do you have you found that workers are doing on their own, domestic workers are, you mentioned there were different kinds of cooperatives and different kind of strategies. Can you comment a little bit on those?
Sure. Cooperatives have largely been utilized by those workers who are hired directly by individual homeowners or clients. And what a cooperative does is it's basically somewhat of a loose-knit association of individual workers who come together, who are trying to leverage their collectivity, who recognize that when they're fighting solo, they're not going to get very far. And so what the worker cooperatives have done, some of the most recent ones, have been cooperatives where the members only use, for example, eco-friendly cleaning products, which goes a long way to addressing the types of health and safety concerns that come about because workers are using really toxic cleaning agents without proper training and without, for example, using gloves.
Okay, so you have workers who are doing this kind of work without wearing gloves?
Oh, without a doubt. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, again, if you think about the context in which this work is being done, we just don't think about the fact that all of these cleaning agents that involve toxic chemicals would be dangerous because we say to ourselves, well, you know, a housewife can go in and pick it up from the grocery store and she would use that. So how could it be dangerous? And what people fail to appreciate is, one, some of these products can be inherently dangerous, right, if used in the incorrect way, and two, domestic service workers are using these products on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. Housewives are not, right? Mm-hmm. So there is a far higher rate of exposure to chemical agents that you don't see with housewives, and you have situations where workers don't appreciate, I ought to use product A to do test A. Mm-hmm. I ought to use product B to do test B.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so just to close off, if there's anything that you could recommend, perhaps, as a lasting thought of how we can address the issue of, I don't know, simultaneously smashing the idea of the home as being this completely private sphere where we can't look into regulating, or how could we empower workers to make sure that their health and safety rights are respected? What would you say?
Well, you know, I will repeat a theme of the conference, which is we absolutely need laws that extend to domestic service workers. One of the problems that we've had in the U.S. and that we continue to have is that a lot of health and safety standards do not apply to domestic service workers. So as an initial matter, we need to address that. But we also need to recognize that's only the first step. Mm-hmm. Having a law on the book goes a long way, if only for the symbolic value to indicate to the world that these workers ought to be treated just like any other worker. But because of some of the, what shall I say, particularities of the work, given that it's in the private home, having the law on the book is only the beginning. You have to figure out how can you actually make sure that this law is going to be effective and enforced.
Welcome back to Spitfire Women of Color Radio, only on CKUT 90.3 FM. The time is now 6:30, and that was an interview by May Nam, which I hope you all enjoyed. We are now going to begin our interview with Miss Christiana about the funny or racist panel discussion at McGill that happened last March. So, Christiana, can you give us a little bit of a context about what that panel discussion was on?
Okay, so essentially the panel discussion was dealing extensively with the recent uprise in blackface in universities. So we had the one that happened, I'm quite sure it was UDAM, and then there was one that happened on our McGill campus as well, during an event that SMU held.
Four floors.
And so the panel discussion was just basically trying to engage in a dialogue or a discourse about why there's the recent uprising, and thinking about where this is coming from, but also situating it in the context of its historical legacy as something that is very racist. But I guess the panelist, I guess the funny part was to think about whether or not it can be humorous, though that wasn't something I was interested in hearing about. But nevertheless, just basically extensively going through the issue of blackface. And so we had five panelists, only four of which I remember. Charmaine Nelson was there. Anthony Morgan was there. I think he's a human rights lawyer advocate, was there. Fo Nemi, and then Julius Gray. And then there was a comedian by the name of blank. I don't remember his name.
A comedian.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. But in terms of dialogue, do you think it was actually useful to have that panel discussion? Because I heard there was a lot of negative backlash that came out of it in terms of being able to reciprocate when the line would be drawn between what is appropriate to be said and then how it would be received by the audience. And I know there was, I think, a letter that was kind of circulating about kind of getting the mediator of that discussion to kind of own up to the fact that this turned into a circus when it was actually supposed to be, you know, an intellectual conversation about whether or not blackface is comedic or not, and the whole, like you said, the whole history behind it, et cetera, et cetera.
I think that the panel discussion in and of itself, from Phonemi to the beginning, so Anthony Morgan, who went first, Charmaine Nelson, and then, Semi, the comedian, and then Phonemi, was really, really productive knowledge. Charmaine Nelson, from like my memory, was flawless. She gave an extensive historical background, talked about whiteness in relation to it. Like, it was fabulous. Then we got to Julius Gray, who decided he was gonna come in, you know what I mean? Free guns a-blowing, talking about how he felt as though, or he didn't believe in political correctness and was going to conduct his discussion in that way. And so he basically came in not talking about blackface, let's be honest, and babbled about the Greeks. I don't know, this is blackface, I don't see any Greeks here, but okay. And so went on talking about the Greeks, and then went on to make some really like problematic statements, semi-conflating homosexuality with pedophilia at some point, made the claim about not needing or not desiring ethnicity, and that we should assimilate, the question being whom and to what should be assimilated. It was just really, really problematic. And so in terms of the reception, I don't know, the letter circulating is really important, because what it's doing is it's asking for the moderator to be held accountable for having particular individuals come on the panel as without reason. Like, I don't understand why Julius Gray was there. Not, I don't think, because it wasn't an intellectual discourse. Because I think what had happened there, where emotions were rising, me, myself, I, after Julius Gray's comments, I was really emotional and proceeded to cry, because I did not know how this man could come up here and tell me that I need to assimilate to what, I don't understand. And so one of my professors had made a note of that, and he tried to call me out my name, and we don't do that around here. So I had to put him in his place, and I basically yelled from the back of the arena that you are a bleep racist. And he tried to say something, but obviously my voice overpowers his, so no one heard what he was saying. And so it was just like, I think that the emotion that was coming out of that was real. And to like echo like Audre Lorde's like use or uses of anger, it's like these kinds of economies of affectivity happen. They're real. They need to be addressed and they need to be taken care of. But what had happened with the moderator was he was trying to regulate people's feelings. Like, no, no, decorum. No, 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 silence. No, 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 you have a racist on the panel. You need to get him off the panel. Like, you know what I mean? So, yeah.
Because I remember discussing this with my friends, and they were saying, like, the complete opposite, whereas, like, they're saying
the complete opposite.
Well, not the complete opposite, but they're like, yeah, things got out of hand, but the letter shouldn't, like, all this blame and all this anger should not be directed towards the moderator so much, but towards Mr. Gray.
Okay. I understand where that's coming from. I think that what the letter was trying to do was hold accountable someone who knew, because when you create a panel, you know who you're inviting.
That's true.
You knew who you were inviting, and you took up for him in the context of the conversation, where you see him making blatant racist statements and you're still trying to defend this man, or trying to regulate students' emotions, who racialize students' emotions, who feel like they're being violently attacked in the panel. And so I think that that's where that came from. And so I think what the letter or not very explicitly does, but it's evident, is that they're not trying to particularly throw the blame on Julius Gray, because if he wasn't there, there wouldn't have been a problem. We need to hold accountable the individual who thought that it was okay, number one, to create an event that he would juxtapose as humorous with something that's racist, blackface, or funny, or whatever. No. Like, you know? So it was, yeah, the energy was, I think, rightly so, directed to the individual who it needed to be directed to, because Julius Gray doesn't even work at the institution anymore, whereas the I don't know his last name.
Mendelson?
No. He is the he works at a different post. This one's a professor. Mendelson something or something Mendelson. He is the one who works at the institution and created the event.
Okay. And how do you think this ties into the kind of overall theme, if you want to call it a theme, of the discussion concerning free speech?
Oh, that was a very interesting shouts out to Alyssa, who isn't here. But I remember she called me after the event, not knowing really what happened because she left early. And so I told her, and she had made a really poignant notation about the fact that this man is calling for free speech and says, or I'm trying to be charitable to his argument. I think that what he was trying to say is blackface is a form of free speech and we shouldn't regulate free speech. And when I call you a racist from the back of the room, you get mad and start getting upset. But wait a minute, isn't this my free speech? Hold up. So we really need to complicate what we mean by free speech, because if free speech is coming at the expense of my well-being, my safety, my happiness, then you are going to have to silence yourself real quick. So I think that in the context of this idea, like this concept of free speech, like, of course, I'm very much in support of freedom of speaking because it attaches to so many things, writing, you know what I mean, expressing oneself, and having all of that access. But I don't believe that it can ever exist to or exist in such a way where it infringes on the like well-being, psychological, emotional, physical well-being of other bodies.
So basically, do you think there is ever going to be a compromise between where the line is drawn between freedom of speech and offense? Or do you think that line is just going to be constantly blurred to the point where we can't differentiate between the two anymore?
I think that that's a really interesting question, because I think that that one is rooted very much in our understandings of race and race relations in our current society. And I think that a lot of discussion about free speech comes from a very privileged standpoint of individuals who have access to so much speech that when they feel it being inhibited or when they feel it being in some way limited, they feel like they have to scream free speech. Like, I have the right to free speech, not taking into account how speech has been systematically taken away from bodies of color, queer folk, trans folk, like, you know, persons with disabilities / disabled bodies, like it's a thing. And so I don't know if we'll ever see a reconciliation of both, just because I think that the current climate of race relations right now is one that there is still a great deal of polarity in terms of people of color, or I should just say the racially privileged and the not, or the privileged and the not. And so I think it will be very different. We have a long way to go for that to come into fruition or a reconciliation to happen.
Well, thank you, Christiana, for that wonderful discussion as usual. And
yeah, thanks so much. Hopefully, there will be many more. Again.
Anytime, anytime.
This is your last year here.
Oh, my goodness.
Don't leave.
We're going to miss you so much.
I'll come visit. I will. It's like 6 hours away. I'm going to Toronto. So why not?
So again, that was Christiana Collision. She and you're listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio, only on CKUT 90.3 FM.
I was walking home looking at the trees. Got the feeling that they were looking back at me. Thoughts that occurred to me. The usual kind, and I don't.
they'll build on. Says want to connect. Last night in my dream I was talking to you. You know who you are, where you're dreaming to. 'Cause in my life things are built on, they're built on. This guy, he was not so shy and not that kind. We spoke and suddenly I could read his mind. You think it's bad, but I don't fool myself. You think it's odd, 'cause in my life things are built on, they're built on, they're built on.
Welcome back to Spitfire Women of Color Radio, only on CKUT 90.3 FM. So right now, I want to start a discussion on Beyoncé's documentary, Life is But a Dream, that came out in February on HBO. And it's kind of interesting considering this is someone who I think kind of...
Who you love.
Well, you know...
Yasmin adores.
I'm not going to say love. Love's kind of a strong word that signals commitment, and I'm not ready for that commitment right now, so I'm sorry. But yeah, just amidst all this, as I'm gonna quote you on this one, Yasmin, Beyonce mania that's been happening like the last couple of months with
it's
the concert, the Super Bowl performance, this documentary, and God knows what else. It's really interesting that, like what I was saying before, this is someone I consider to be highly private about her life. You never hear anything about her aside from what she puts out there in terms of, like, exactly her career. So it's just kind of interesting to get this inside look into who Beyonce is and what she is about. And, I mean, there's some parts where you look at it and you're like, this is very authentic. This is very real. She's exactly what she's out to portray, right? This is someone who's trying to connect with her fans on this, you know, people basis. Oh, Victoria, your face. And yet at the same time, there's this kind of inauthenticity about it in some parts of it, especially when it comes to her relationship with Jay-Z, not to knock it. I'm not trying to knock it. All you Beyonce fans, put down your pitchforks. I am not trying to knock this. But at the same time, it's kind of like, you can't really be this happy. Mm-hmm. Because there's parts of it, yes, it, you get to see her life based on these video diaries, her interview with this one person who's basically interviewing her, looking at the clips of her video, of her home concerts, her home videos, concerts, basically her childhood. And then you see her and Jay-Z, and then it's kind of like, I don't know how this fits in, because then you kind of get lost in the, oh, baby, I love you. But it's a sickening, God, I can't watch this anymore, because it's just too much.
Yeah, the stuff about her life is really superficial.
Yeah.
And it makes me wonder, like, if this is, like, the real Beyonce, then what about, like, all these things you hear in the media? Like, for instance, when she gave birth and her locking down the hospital and preventing other parents who just had children from going to see their own kids because she's in the vicinity. I'm sorry? You're supposed to be down to earth and real? And this is what you're portraying? I don't know.
Yeah, she doesn't really, like, address.
That's where I'm kind of confused. Like, it's good to have that, but at the same time, like, how do you differentiate, like, real Beyonce from Beyonce in the media?
I think my thing with Beyonce is sometimes, even though I adore her, is that, oh, I love her music, is more so that, like, she has been shaped and formed by her father, mm-hmm, from, like, such a young age. She was, you know, created by, like, her image was, like, legit created by him. And I feel like since she's been conditioned, you know, to just portray this public figure for so long, mm-hmm, I think that's where the inauthenticity stems from, is like she's like a product. Someone created her to make her appealing, and I think I don't think she's ever going to get away from that, just because it started at such a young age for her, mm-hmm, you know. And fair, it's just enough. Like, you can't really be real. Like, you were structured, your life was so structured for almost your whole entire adult life, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just, I don't think it's ever going to happen. And I feel like that's kind of plays into, like, her and Jay-Z looking like the perfect couples, because, like, I think she was taught, you always have to be perfect. You always have to be your best. And I don't think they would ever put in them arguing like a normal couple, just because that doesn't fit in with her image of this perfect woman, you know?
And but I think, and even self in the documentary, you can see that she prides not so much on perfection, but just being her own person and, mm-hmm, showing that she is her own person. Mm-hmm. And, like, I didn't realize how, quote unquote, feminist, if you want to use that term.
I don't think Beyonce's a feminist.
Well, I mean, she seems to she is a feminist, but, like, just how very, I don't know what the word is to use for that, because
let's talk about how, okay, so let's talk about, like, how she actually construes feminism in the film.
Okay, well, I guess where she,
like you mentioned, like, girls rule the world. That's part of her quote-unquote feminism.
That, I think if we look at her music, we can see that she's not a feminist, because I feel like a lot of her songs, like, I'm gonna cook for my man, or, you know what I mean, I'm gonna take care of my man, and, mm-hmm, then, like, if you guys remember the hit single Bills, Bills, Bills by Destiny's Child, it was like, this man's not paying my bills, so I'm not gonna stay with him, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, like, I think Beyonce's an entertainer, but I don't think she's a feminist by any means.
Because with her, like, what you get is that she stands by these values to be like, women need to be independent, like, strong, mm-hmm, women, blah, 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 blah. And you get that. And you can see the passion and, like, mm-hmm, how she feels about being able to stand on your own two feet without having, I don't know, a man lord over you, right, that kind of thing. Right, like, you are his equal. But then again, it comes back to what you said with all these lyrics. It's like, where does that
come
from?
Even, the name of her tour is the Miss Carter, like what you brought up, Victoria. It's like the Mrs. Carter tour. You know what I mean? And, like, if you're so...
that's contestable. Because, I mean, Miss Carter is her married name, no? Like, and I don't see, like, how that is... like,
but, you know what? But at the same time, like, she's Beyonce. Still. You know what I mean? You utter that word and you know exactly what it means and who it's, mm-hmm, referring to. And it's like, that's not enough to stand on its own. You have to bring in the fact that, like, you're now a married woman. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's just hard for me to... I feel like if she's such a great, powerful figure, why, mm-hmm, does she need that? You know what I mean?
I guess I say that.
Well,
I
it's interesting because Alyssa mentioned during our meeting earlier this month that she's made a statement about her being like a mosaic for all women of color.
Yeah, I remember that.
So I feel like if you look at her face, you see all, you know, all backgrounds all women, and all races, yeah, like in her mix, oh, because she's so mixed. And I think it's just yet another strategy for being able to peel appeal to different demographics.
Exactly. Because if you notice, white women love Beyonce. It's like they glorify her, and it's kind of like their way of saying, yeah, like we represent, like we ally ourselves with women of color, but they mm-hmm. do it through this figure of Beyonce, and it's like Beyonce is represents all women of color.
Fair enough. It's
a problematic statement, for sure.
What do you think about, do you remember when she speaks about Nina Simone?
Yeah, in terms of how people nowadays aren't listening, hearing the music, but we were so focused on the person mm-hmm. rather than the music behind it. And we're kind of getting lost in all, like, mm-hmm. their personal lives and just them being in the public. And how nobody nowadays is kind of making albums and like a full body of work. And it's so much, it's more about like, let me put something out there. And then by the end of it, it's like, we don't know their names anymore.
Which is so like ironic in that she's doing this biopic. Well, I'm going to, documentary is in question as a category for this video that I kind of watched a little bit, scrolled through.
And I mean,
people have referred to it as propaganda infomercial.
It is, though, in a sense, you know, because it's just, it's, she's showing that, like, oh, I'm not just an amazing pop star, I'm also a normal, relatable person. But you're not, you know what I mean? But she wants to be that. And it's like, you can't have your cake and eat it too. Like, stand by the fact that you're a ridiculously rich pop star and own it, but don't try to pretend that you could relate to me, you know?
I think like, running on that point, I think that is the essence of this documentary.
Yeah.
And why she put it out there.
And why Mercedes feels so brokenhearted after she watched it, because she really thought she was going to, like, meet and a complex.
Well, it's not so much meeting a complex person. It's just, it's fascinating, honest, because it's, you see two sides and you're just like, they fit, but they don't fit. It's like that jigsaw puzzle you have. And, like, you know the analogy where there's just one piece that doesn't fit and you don't know why.
Yeah.
And then you try so hard to figure it out. And then, at the same time, you're looking at this woman being like, I can't tell if you're being real with me or you're just jerking my leg. And that's exactly what I got from this documentary.
Before we're out of time, Alyssa prepared, like, a number of really interesting questions about representations of women of color, representations of us in the media.
I really like the first question.
Yeah, maybe like our guest Emily can you know,
read out the first question.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. I was gonna be more eloquent about that, but sure, yeah, just read the question out, please.
Women of color's representation in pop culture, including music and film, is minimal. We are often portrayed as caricatures of stereotypes that are ingrained in the public imagery. Black women are identified by their buttocks, pelvic areas. Black women are grouped into problematic dichotomies of mommy versus
mammy
versus Jezebel.
Yeah.
All right.
There you go, girl.
Asian women are stereotyped as submissive, often not given speaking roles, or crazy women who know karate.
I totally know karate.
It is now 2013, and there has not been many changes to portrayals in pop culture. How do you think this affects how we've seen and treated in our daily lives, on the street, at school, and at work, in intimate relationships, and or dating situations?
Oh, it affects it in so many ways. Yeah. There's just not enough time to even...
It was so funny when I saw this. It was so... Because me and Emily were actually talking about this kind of last night, and we were saying that, like, especially at a school like ours that's predominantly, you know, white, I feel like as a black woman, when a white guy shows interest in me, it's because, like, he has a black girl fetish. Or, like, if a white guy's, like, interested in an Asian girl, like, he has an Asian girl fetish. Like, it's very hard for me to believe that he likes me independently as a person.
Which is a really interesting turn of this question, because the question's, like, how does society treat us? Not how do we treat ourselves because of society.
Yeah, exactly. But it's so interconnected,
you know? It's the go-to.
And it's just, I can't do it because I'm like, this guy just has all these, like, crazy hypersexualized fantasies about black women, and I don't want to engage in that. I don't want to be used, you know, to fulfill some creepy fantasy. And it sucks, you know, that, like, I can't just interact without having all these thoughts in the back of my mind, you know. Definitely. But yeah.
I mean,
it's a kind of to the point where you're expected to play a certain role. Mm-hmm. So at some point, you just find yourself mm-hmm. playing into it, even though you don't mean to.
Oh my
in
God.
Order That's to make so sure true. That, you know, it's just like, what, no matter what I do, you're still going to
exactly.
be looking for this.
Exactly.
I don't know, completely, I don't know, anti-man, I don't need no yeah. man, I'm bad by myself kind of a woman. And you're looking
She's
for it.
She's wearing a bandana.
No.
It's blue.
It's
I think
black.
She's a Crip.
I'm wearing a black bandana.
She must and, be and part of like, the gang.
No matter what, it's you just like, I'm exactly. expected to have all this attitude, mm-hmm. and I'm just, I'm not like that, or have a lot of sass. Mm-hmm. And even no matter what I say, mm-hmm. it's actually, it's construed as attitude.
Yeah, because people interpret
being
that with predispositions,
so
right?
Where does that leave me? It's like, fine, you want a sassy black woman? I'm gonna give you a sassy black woman. Like, I don't know what else to
no,
do.
So even sometimes in my conferences, like, I think I'm generally just a talkative person, and sometimes when I'm like maybe the only person who's talking in the room, I wonder, like, oh, these people all think like I'm a loud black girl, like I'm fulfilling that stereotype, even though I'm just being myself. You know what I mean? And it's like, even if I was submissive and quiet, like, it doesn't
matter.
They
would still be waiting for it.
Yeah, exactly. Because everyone interprets all, like, all the information around them with their own experiences, so when they're with mm-hmm. their predispositions. You know what I mean? And if you have this predisposition that all black women are loud, doesn't matter how I act, like you said, you're going to think that all black women are loud and obnoxious.
Exactly.
You know? So it's kind of like a game you can't really change.
I mean, we can try. It's not to say that it's impossible,
no,
but
no, for sure.
I think it's really a two-way streak, and it shouldn't only be on, let's say, our side to try and disprove all these stereotypes or make sure they understand that a woman of color is not A, B, C, or D, and mm-hmm. they cannot be categorized. Mm-hmm. And I think it's about having this open dialogue, because that's where everything falls. And if there's that miscommunication, then there is no room for any change to happen. That's just the way I see it.
What about
right,
you, Vic?
Which is, well, yeah, I was just thinking, like, how does this fit in with our discussion about the role of, like, you know, these superstars that mm-hmm. everyone watches and learns, you know, how to treat other people that they identify, you know, in the same racial manner? I don't know. What do you think, Emily? I have so many thoughts, but you're a guest, so I'm going to be nice and hospitable here.
Well, I guess one of the things that's, just to go back to the documentary, is that because, like, Beyoncé's life was so private going into it, and, like, it was very interesting, like, how everything unfolded with, like, the Super Bowl and, like, the documentary and then, like, the announcement with the tour. It was all, like, very timely and well choreographed in her defense. Mm-hmm. But
That's true.
Yeah. Well, because of that, she was allowed to kind of be selective with, like, the type of information she was going to portray about herself, like, in the documentary. So in that way, like, I think that the majority of people interpreted the documentary just as is and aren't really questioning it to the degree that we are. Mm-hmm. So it's, which is obviously unfortunate, but I think that, like, back to what Mercedes was saying, is that that's part of the problem with, like, people being able to change people's opinions about it, because if people aren't going to question what they're being, like, fed at, like, if you will, then nothing's really going to change.
Okay, thanks so much for coming into the studio today, Emily, and also wanted to give a shout out to everyone who contributed this month.
Peace.
Turn me up. Ooh, I want to hear the music. Yeah. I want to feel that vibe.
Turn it up.
Are we on the air?
Uh-huh.
You didn't hear?
All over the world, man. Gotta make that money, man. Make your money, y'all. Just do what you got to do.